It's Tuesday, May 26, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Hey Stashers, Radical Russ here. You are listening to a best of the Daily Audio Stash for the week of May 26, 2009. We're getting ready for the Aspen Legal Seminar on June 4th, 5th, and 6th, so we're going to have some downtime here at the Stash. We're bringing back some of your favorites from the previous Daily Audio Stashes over the past 14 months, so you're going to get a little bit of reefer madness, some stupid stoner stories, some great cannabis science from Dr. Mitch Earlywine, and some of my favorite songs from the Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com. I'll have plenty of live information coming from Aspen Legal Seminar over the weekend of June 4th, 5th, and 6th, audio and video to be posted later. Thank you so much for understanding. Keep up on the blog at stash.normal.org. I'll be posting somewhat infrequently during these next couple of weeks, but if there's any new breaking news stories, you'll find them there on the Stash. We'll be back with all original shows on Monday, June 8th, 2009. So sit back and enjoy the best of your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Dr. Phil focuses on cannabis, ignores antidepressants in Omaha mall shooting. Last year, there was a horrible tragedy in Omaha when Robert Hawkins, 19, went to the mall and began shooting innocent people, killing 8 and himself. Yesterday, Hawkins' mother Molly appeared on the Dr. Phil television program so the two of them could get real about what led her son to go on a shooting rampage.
New Dr. Phil. The deadliest mall massacre in U.S. history. Now.
I do feel responsible.
Did the teen gunman's mother.
Those people that Robert killed, they were entitled to be saved.
Miss fatal warning signs.
Threats of killing or hurting people.
And.
Did you smoke marijuana with this kid?
What will this shooting victim say to her?
You knew there was an AK-47. You can't ignore these signs.
While Dr. Phil did emphasize Robert's troubled family life, history of depression and psychotic episodes, and easy access to an AK-47 assault rifle in exploring the reasons behind Robert's suicidal rampage, he also goes to great lengths to emphasize Robert's use of cannabis. One of his first questions to the mom is, "Did you smoke marijuana with the kid?" She admits that she had smoked marijuana with him once when he was 18 and a half on Thanksgiving. Dr. Phil references Robert's marijuana smoking four times, three marijuanas and one smoke illegal drugs. Do you suppose he's trying to influence his audience by leading them to think marijuana use turns people into violent sociopaths? Because if Dr. Phil is looking for a pharmacological reason for Robert's imbalance, he's not paying very close attention to all the possibilities. I ran a search on the Dr. Phil transcript looking for depressant, medication, and anti, and that brought me exactly one match in the entire 60-minute show, a reference to the time he was put on antipsychotics at the age of 3 and a half following molestation. And that led me to my good friend the Google. I wonder what fascinating things I can learn about young male spree killers and antidepressant medications. Well, a look at the CNN website for Anderson Cooper 360 brought me an interview with one of his friends, Sean Sanders, who said he wasn't sure how depressed Robert was, but knew that he was on antidepressants for the last couple of months. Now, looking back to some of the horrible mass shootings perpetrated by depressed young men, some of which Dr. Phil mentioned on his show, we go all the way back to 98 and Kip Kinkle in Oregon. He was on Prozac. In Notice, Idaho in 99, Sean Cooper fired a couple shotgun rounds in his school. He was on antidepressants. Of course, the notorious Columbine Massacre of April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris was on antidepressants, and Dylan Klebold's autopsy was never released. In May of 1999, T.J. Solomon in Georgia was on antidepressants when he wounded six of his classmates. In March of 2000, a 14-year-old girl named Elizabeth was on Prozac when she blasted away at students in Pennsylvania. March of 2001, El Cajon, 18-year-old Jason Hoffman was on Effexor and Celexa when he opened fire at his high school. April 10th of 2001, in Washington State, Corey Badsgard took a rifle to his high school, held classmates hostage while he was on a high dose of Effexor. In March of 2005, on the Red Lake Indian Reservation, Jeff Weiss, a 16-year-old, was under the influence of Prozac when he shot and killed nine people. And in 2006, in Bailey, Colorado, Dwayne Morrison went to his high school, shot and killed a girl, sexually assaulted six others. They found antidepressants in his vehicle. It isn't even controversial to point out that these antidepressant drugs lead to violence and suicidal ideation among young men. Such warnings are clearly printed on what they call a black box label on these drugs. Antidepressants increase the risk of suicidal thinking and behavior in children and adolescents with major depressive disorder and other psychiatric disorders. The warning begins. Those risks must be balanced against clinical need, the label indicates, in a warning surrounded by a black box, hence the black box designation. The new warnings will be carried on all antidepressants, including Anafrinil, Aventil, Celexa, Cymbalta, Desirel, Effexor, Elavil, Lexapro, Ludiamil, Luvox, Marplan, Nardil, Norpramin, Pamelor, Parnate, Paxil, Pexiva, Prozac, Remeron, Seraphim, Serzone, Cinequan, Sermentil, Symbiax, Tofranil, Tofranil PM, Triavil, Vivactil, Wellbutrin, Zoloft, and Zyban. And they say the names of medical marijuana strains are silly. Most of the rest of the civilized world won't even allow doctors to prescribe these medications to young people. But here in the United States, there is a lot of money to be made by scaring people to tell their doctor to prescribe the latest pill to make up for bad or negligent parenting. Why wouldn't Dr. Phil pay as much attention to the cocktails of antidepressant pharmaceutical medications Robert Hawkins was taking as to the cannabis he was smoking? Short answer? Cannabis doesn't buy any commercials on the Dr. Phil show.
Stupid Stoner Stories. As a public service, Normal reminds you that smoking marijuana will not make one stupid. However, some stupid people do smoke marijuana. Don't be one of those stoners that make the rest of us look bad. Learn your lesson from today's
Stupid Stoner Story.
Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Minutes after he was arrested on bail for marijuana possession, Adelbert Harvey was arrested again in Market Square Tuesday afternoon for allegedly mooning people, say police. As a result, Harvey, age 35, with no permanent address, faces three Class A misdemeanor charges of possession of drugs, breach of bail conditions, and indecent exposure slash lewdness. According to police, they received reports from witnesses nearly 10 minutes after Harvey was released about him exposing his buttocks in the middle of downtown. Prosecutors argued that Harvey should be held on cash bail because of the fact that he violated terms of his release nearly 10 minutes after being arrested for the marijuana charge. Judge Sawiko Gardner asked Harvey if the court could trust him to stay on good behavior, after which he responded with, quote, "If I don't drink, I guess," end quote. While admitting to having a drinking problem, Harvey said he was still intoxicated when released on the first charge and called his latest arrest a wake-up call.
Don't you just hate it when you get a story about a messed up alcoholic doing something really stupid? But since marijuana is illegal, people will equate breaking the law on marijuana with the stupid things that were caused by the alcohol.
There were 765,000 marijuana arrests in 2007. That's not for dealers and kingpins, no, that's just for simple possession. Multiply that by the average cost of each arrest, and what have you got? $7.6 billion spent on people just smoking some pot. That's enough money to buy health insurance for every child that needs it. That's enough cash to adopt every stray dog and enough left over to feed it. Mr. Obama, I kinda wrote this song for you. You got my vote for change. Now let's see what you can do.
Visit normal.org today. The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your Toker Tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers. And nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
Who is telling you the truth about marijuana? The government? Scientists? Doctors? Which claims are scientifically valid and which claims are reefer madness? Every Wednesday, we separate the stems of propaganda from the buds of truth with NORML's look at cannabis science.
As we do Wednesday on the Daily Audio Stash, we're always joined here for Cannabis Science by Dr. Mitch Earlywine, who's an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York in Albany. Dr. Earlywine, welcome back to the Stash.
Great to be back.
Hey, I was going through the Google, as it's called, and I noticed a story coming out of Long Island, one of the Long Island papers here, mentioned a study that you've published having to do with teen use of marijuana in the states that have passed medical marijuana laws. And of course, you know, the big message here, they always said that if we passed medical marijuana, it would send kids the wrong message. So what kind of message have the kids received from medical marijuana?
In fact, if it translates into use, they're not getting a bad message at all. It looks like every state that has passed medical marijuana laws has either seen a leveling or a small decrease in use of cannabis subsequent to the passage of those laws. Some of those states have had these laws enacted, you know, a long time ago, others more recently. You know, California is probably the test case, and it's been 11 years since they've had medical marijuana, and we've actually seen decrease in teen marijuana use in that state. Rodney Skager talks about this in a chapter in my book, Pot Politics, and points out that, in fact, it was very hard for him to get the word out that this was the result after the passage of the medical marijuana laws there. And I think it's intriguing that now that this has been replicated in several other states, to see that any concerns about medical marijuana passing some kind of bad message to teens doesn't seem to be the case, and it actually may be that teens see this as, you know, something that it's for AIDS and cancer and things like that. I don't really want to mess with it. Or they may be more familiar with people who are users who can actually give them a valuable list of what are the pros and cons of use and encourage them to either wait until later in life or to not use cannabis at all.
Well, I'm no social scientist, but I had my own theory on this, and it has to do with, you know, kids being rebellious. They always want to rebel against what their parents do, and once marijuana becomes no longer this hip underground drug, and now it's just, you know, granny's glaucoma medicine, it's not that hip anymore.
It's funny how that whole forbidden fruit aspect seems to be quite the big deal. And so if suddenly you can't show that you're the hip person who disobeys adults in such a dramatic way by using this, maybe that really does take away some of the incentive to go ahead and try.
Do you suppose that maybe teens are affected by any of these, these scary stories that we hear about teenage use and psychosis and the possible, you know, lead to schizophrenia? Let's go over that a little bit. And just, you know, is that affecting the kids in any way, you think?
I don't get that impression. Almost invariably, they know users. So they seem to know somebody who uses who isn't psychotic, and so when they hear about these kinds of tests, I'm afraid it costs us some credibility as far as, you know, how we talk to them and what they believe. So I'm afraid these little white lies about marijuana making you crazy hurt us down the line if I want to say something like, oh, by the way, methamphetamine can shrink your brain. And even though that's empirically supported, they might say, well, aren't you the guy who told me marijuana makes you schizophrenic? And then they sort of lose their attention.
Sure. And speaking about shrinking the brain, that was another one of these scare stories that just recently came out where they showed that the people who were heavy marijuana users had shrinkage in their hippocampus and amygdala. And what did you have to think about that particular study?
I looked really closely at that, and actually it's extremely well done. They found a very small sample of folks who were extremely heavy users and who didn't use tons and tons of other drugs, which is often no easy feat. But these were guys who smoked 5 joints a day every day for over a decade. I mean, clearly that's going to, you know, have some impact, as, you know, any kind of drug would. And what we're actually looking at is really small decreases in brain areas that are involved in emotion and memory, which we know, you know, cannabis alters. So yeah, if I, you know, have to say something, don't smoke 5 joints a day every day for 10 years. I'm not sure how many, you know, hundreds of thousands of people should be arrested given those data, but right. The study was actually really well done, and by a team that's, you know, very good with that kind of brain structure analyses. But I should mention, too, that, you know, 5 beers a day would be markedly worse for not only the hippocampus and amygdala, but actually the brain ventricles and things like that. So clearly, you know, relative to other illicit drugs, these harms are relatively minor.
Yeah, something that Normal's deputy director, Paul Armentano, pointed out is that every time they do these studies to try to purport these harms for marijuana, it always seems like they're getting the guys that are, you know, stoned all day, every day, you know, massive quantity amounts of cannabis.
Well, as you can imagine, it's really hard to find these effects with anybody else. So somebody who's just getting high on the weekends, even if it has been for a decade, is unlikely to actually show these effects, in part because, you know, the brain is very plastic. The brain adapts, and the brain can make dramatic rebounds, even if there were small, minor effects of using cannabis once in a while.
Another one of the big scare stories, and this one always seems to come across just about every year, the ONDCP releases their Potency Monitoring Project report, and this year they say, you know, marijuana's twice as bad. You know, it was 4% in the 80s and 9% now, which I guess is a good thing, because they're not saying it's, you know, 20 times or 400 times as bad, like I've heard in some other stories. But how does marijuana's potency affect the user in any way?
This is comic, because the late John Morgan pointed out that in the 1970s, they were already talking about marijuana being markedly stronger. In the early 1980s, Peggy Mann published a book suggesting that marijuana had increased 100 times, which I guess it would be all pure THC now.
Yeah.
Or something. I mean, it's just clearly an overestimate. This new data, however, is extremely accurate. I really trust El Soli and the group down there who does these analyses. What's curious about this, though, is that they're getting more and more of the, shall we say, international crop, and that seems to selectively weighted into the computation of the average. So I do not really think that the average person is getting 9% THC in his or her cannabis purchased throughout the United States. But then the tacit assumption is, oh, yeah, stronger pot, more dangerous, ooh. And, I mean, I can understand if you're accustomed to, you know, seeing somebody down a big bottle of whiskey versus just drinking a beer, that maybe you would think, oh, more potent, more dangerous. As Tashkin's lab and a few other folks have shown, James Zagney in particular, people tend to moderate how big a puff they take and how long they hold the inhalation, depending upon the strength of the cannabis. And this research was done with cannabis that was 2% and 4% THC. I'm quite optimistic that folks who are inhaling 9% THC cannabis definitely moderate their dose, and often brag that this is one-hit pot, that this is not the kind of thing where you have to use as much. And so, of course, although we know, you know, cannabis doesn't cause lung cancer, there are respiratory irritants in smoke, and you're going to be exposed to markedly fewer of them by using this strong cannabis. And, you know, obviously I would encourage everybody to vaporize instead, but again, this doesn't seem to be the big horror story that some folks have sort of implied.
Yeah, and we also find with potency that the iron law of prohibition kicks in, that, you know, a prohibited product always becomes stronger as the bootleggers, you know, it happened back in the 20s, as the bootleggers try to promote that product, and users that don't know what they're getting tend to want to go for the stronger varieties. They've shown those studies of the smokers in Amsterdam who tend to prefer the more moderate varieties of cannabis.
It's funny, too, because back in Prohibition, when my grandmother was running various things to help people out and getting their alcohol, you did find that it was ease of transport that was the big issue. So you could get, you know, whiskey across much easier than a comparable amount of alcohol and beer simply because it was a smaller volume. And we do see this kind of same reaction to cannabis under the situations that we're in with Prohibition. I would be curious to see if not only could we see people cultivate out in the open and take advantage of the idea that you don't need the strongest product in order to have the best one, but also a lot of times we're seeing folks report, you know, oh, this is really strong, but they don't have any real measure of the THC, and there may be other cannabinoids in there contributing to certain effects. The medicinal effects seem to be related to cannabidiol as well as THC. So we've got a big opportunity here to look at a really complex plant that does all kinds of wild things to the body, and yet we don't get that opportunity simply because of current prohibitions.
Yeah, I often imagine the day when prohibition is ended and marijuana is legally taxed and regulated, and how nice it would be to be able to get some consumer marijuana, and right there on the package maybe it would have the percentage listings of THC and cannabidiol and all of these other components of the plant. It'd be a very nice system to live under, for sure.
Well, and then the fun of that opportunity is it's easier to add age restrictions to gain, tax and regulated funds and really make good use of that money to increase public awareness about any negative health consequences and encourage folks to come in for treatment if they feel like they're using maladaptively and let others just enjoy it as they wish.
Well, Doctor, one last thing here. You had sent me this little bit from one of your students, and I thought this was quite interesting on how people perceive how pot is going to affect them may actually affect them when they have tests on their use of pot.
This was an intriguing study, and I'm really pleased with my student, Allison Luby. She's done a great job on this. But basically, we had folks who'd smoked many times in their lives come into the lab, and they read a little paragraph saying either, oh, by the way, marijuana makes you really bad at these tasks, or by the way, marijuana doesn't have any effect on these tasks. And the men did basically just as they were told. If they were told, hey, this is going to impede your performance, sure enough, they did worse than if they had read the paragraph saying marijuana doesn't have any effect. Which makes me think that in some ways this sort of stereotype threat about cannabis and cognitive performance may be the source of at least some of these effects we see in the literature about, oh, marijuana messes up your performance on neuropsychological tasks. The funny part is that the women did the exact opposite.
Huh.
And I think for women, being a cannabis user may be, you're more in the rarity and you really want to combat any stereotypes. So when women read that marijuana was supposed to impede their performance, they actually did better than if they read that marijuana had no impact. And I think the moral there is, hey, don't mess with women who use cannabis.
I guess that's a good lesson for any time, I believe. All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Earlywine, for joining us again here on the Daily Audio Stash with all the news about the cannabis science that we can use here.
Splendid being on the show.
All right. Thanks, Mitch. It's tough talking to kids about marijuana, especially if you might be a parent who dabbled a time or two in your youth. So to help you out, get your copy of Dr. Mitch Earlywine's latest book, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. Dr. Earlywine is an associate professor of psychology at the State University of New York at Albany and an expert on the studies concerning marijuana, its effect on health and society, and the methodology behind the statistics. He is a frequent guest here on our Daily Audio Stash. Dr. Earlywine lays it all out without the propaganda and scare tactics that parents know won't work with teenagers. He presents a rational understanding of cannabis, what it is and what it isn't, and why kids shouldn't be using marijuana. You can order today through Amazon.com or check our links at our blog, stash.normal.org. Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.marijuana.org.
stash.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.norml.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. Thanks for tuning in to this Best of Normal Daily Audio Stash episode. We really appreciate it and remind you that we'll be back with new shows on June 8, 2009. In the meantime, get involved. Join Normal at norml.org today. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.